Nice. Soul on ice. I'ma put my soul on ice. Nice.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, or good night. Thank you for listening to us wherever or wherever you are. This is the show that brings the heat. Soul on Ice, the podcast. My name is Kwame. Always a big shout out to our boy, Brother B, holding it down on social media. If you want to check us out, make sure you go to Soul on Ice, the podcast. Hit us up. Make sure you subscribe, rate, and review. We'd love the love. Double Trouble is usually in the house, but Akil Thomas is in Germany right now. I'm not sure if we're going to hear from him on this episode, but we'll soon get an update on how things are going with him out there, making the trek, holding it down for the Kings organization, which is really cool. I'm really excited to hear about all of that. But we've got Elijah Robinson in the house. What's going on, E?
Too much. I've actually been pretty busy recently with starting school and practices and a few other things going on. So now been down in Toronto for almost a month now, getting pretty used to it, getting into routine, but a lot of good things going on and school is going pretty well so far.
Yeah, Toronto is a very interesting place to live if you have never lived out here. I mean, I grew up in Toronto, so I'm kind of used to it. Just a quick side note for everybody. Coming up in the show, we've got Valdemar James, a.k.a. Val James, a.k.a. one of the toughest men to ever play in the National Hockey League. You're going to love this interview coming up. But how's everything going with your team? Because you were playing for Ryerson University. How is it out there with the boys? Are you getting settled in?
Yeah, things have been good. During the summer, I got the chance to meet a few of my teammates, but now we have practices 3 times a week and workouts the other 2 days. So every single day we're all together and getting pretty close with some of the guys and really getting into a routine and really like the coaches and starting to fit in pretty well. And it's been pretty good so far.
So when is the season starting? How is university hockey adjusting to the whole COVID situation?
So the way it's looking right now is mid-October, we're going to get an official announcement, or they're going to let us know if we're going to have a season or not. The main thing before was if classes are going to be online. The argument for why are classes online, but we're still having sports. So I guess with the way cases are going, they're going to monitor it. And mid-October, we're going to get a decision if we're going to have a season or not. But here at Ryerson, we're just making sure we're prepared because year in, year out, we're always one of the best teams. And, you know, I think there's a lot of schools who aren't really doing anything right now, and we're getting a little bit of an edge for on those teams if we end up having a season.
So if there is no season, what does that mean for you? Because you got a scholarship for to go to Ryerson. So that takes away a year of playing. How does that affect you going forward?
Yeah, so I'm not too sure yet, but they might put in a rule where we can go play somewhere else and not have to redshirt the following year, and you keep your whole school package. So that's something I briefly talked to my agent about finding somewhere else to go play if we don't have a season. But, of course, you got to wait to see what the rules are behind it and how it all works. And if it's comes to a point where I can't go play somewhere else, and if I do, I'm going to lose my package, then I'm sure I'll just keep training the whole year and keep my school package. That's something that's pretty important to me. But, yeah, I'm definitely looking at options if there is no season.
So is there a possibility that you can do what Akil has done and a lot of other young guys, which is playing abroad in, like, Germany, which seems like a really good idea for young guys that are trying to keep their game going and looking like the one possibility that they have right now?
Yeah, I think that's a real possibility. I mean, there's a lot of good leagues all over Europe, and to explore those options. And if I'm able to go down there and maybe make a little bit of money and it's not going to cost me my eligibility or anything, that's something I might look at or look into. And I also just started my application for dual citizenship to get a British or to become a British citizen. So
really?
Yeah. My mom's from England and she's not Canadian yet. So
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to help me get that for sure.
So what would you want that dual citizenship for? Just cause, or is it hockey related?
Just cause, but I think it is also hockey related, because I think it would allow me to play there not as a non-import. And a lot of the teams, you can only have a certain amount of imports on the team. So I think it would just create more options for me to play and, yeah, kind of give me more choice.
And you're still holding it down on the forward. How's that been with the practice, the adjustment from defense to offense?
It's a lot more fun in practice. I mean, as a D, anyone who plays D knows you can go an entire practice without really shooting the puck or anything like that. And at forward, every drill, your hands are involved. You're getting lots of shots. So for a practice standpoint, I'm loving it so far. It's a lot of fun. And I'm hoping the season might start in January, but there's a chance that we can play exhibition games before that or scrimmages or whatever. So I'm hoping I get a chance to kind of get in a game-like situation as a forward.
All right. Well, good luck. It sounds a lot of fun, and keep us posted and we'll see how that goes. But we are just going to just hold it down for a few seconds, because when we come back, Balthimore James, keep it locked. You're going to love this interview. You're rocking with the best right here. So on Ice, the podcast, baby. Okay, so born in 1957, this young man had the toughest job in the game of hockey, the enforcer. Born in Florida, he was not expected to play hockey, let alone play in the NHL, but he did both. In the NHL's 1981-82 season, he became the first American-born black athlete to play the game of hockey at the level of the NHL. The following year, under the direction of rookie coach Iron Mike Keenan, he scored the biggest goal in his career with a game winner for the Rochester Americans in the Calder Cup. His book is called Black Ice, The Val James Story. Let me introduce you to Valdemore Edwin James. What's going on, Val?
Not a whole lot, but it's Valmore Curtis. Someone missed
you. Did I get that wrong? I actually got that wrong in my research.
I know. That's not like you.
It's so not like me.
Call me.
I know.
That's okay, though. That's okay. I won't cry too long over it.
Okay. Hey, so listen, Val, let's first of all, thank you for joining us. And
I just want to thank you guys for having me along. I'm going to enjoy this. I always do.
Yeah, this is going to be fun, man. We want to start with that game-winning goal when you played for the Americans. Walk us through what happened and how that all went down.
Well, let's see. We broke out of the end, and it seemed like just a regular play. And at that point in time, I just come back from Buffalo. So I had a pretty good stride going. I had gotten a little bit faster, but that's what always happens when you play with competition that's a little better than you. So I went in. I was the late man in on the play, and it was slid across to me, and I just let it go. You know, it was a natural get it and shoot. Mm-hmm. And that was the one thing that we had been going over when I had been in Buffalo of getting the shot off quicker. So I caught the goalie, handcuffed him, and it went in, and that was the game winner for the Calder Cup. And it was very exciting. It was like, I guess you can't really put it into words how you felt, but I was very elated. It was one of those things that you know that it's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. You hope that it happens a couple of times, but a lot of times you don't get that lucky.
So just so I can understand this better as a non-professional hockey player, the Calder Cup is the equivalent to the Stanley Cup if you're playing in the American, right? Okay. So that was a big deal for you then.
The American League.
Sorry, say that again?
Yes, it was. It was a huge deal. You know what? The thing is that you always want to be able to contribute to your team in any way you can. Now, like you were saying earlier in the broadcast, I did have one of the toughest jobs in hockey at that point in time, which was being an enforcer, because at that point in time, you have to realize when something happens, you have to step up and do something. Now, whether that be fight with the player that caused the trouble or find someone else out there so that you can even the odds. So they had that same feeling of dejection that you had when they jumped on someone who couldn't defend themselves.
Right.
So it was a long ride. It was fun. a lot of work. I know that I had to make sure that I was stronger than everybody else. So we spent a lot of time in the gym lifting weights. I was naturally strong to begin with, but, you know, you want to have that edge. And I can remember there were always guys coming in every season, and I was the guy that they had to fight in order to prove themselves. So I had no problem getting bouts.
Exactly.
I hate to put it like that.
But it is what it is.
Exactly.
So after the game, you know, you guys are celebrating. What was the celebration like that night with the boys?
Oh, it was incredible. It was like, first of all, the champagne started flowing. You know, we were on the road, so we couldn't really get too crazy because, you know, people are less forgiving and in a visiting town than they are in your own hometown. Mm-hmm. So we did what we had to do. We had a few drinks, and we made our way back to Rochester.
Yeah.
Once we got back, we were kind of shocked that at the airport, there was a crowd and a half down there. We couldn't believe it. I think, to put a number on it, probably about 10,000 people were waiting for us. And we came in rather late, right? So it was a shocker. We had a parade in the next couple of days. And, wow, that was the biggest parade I've ever been in my life. And I'm pretty sure there was over 100,000 people there. It was incredible. It was one of those, another moment in my life that I'll never forget. I had won three championships down in Erie, Pennsylvania at the time, back to back to back. So it was that, like that same moment only in the higher league. And who can complain when you can come from the minors off of a championship and then go into the next step, which would be the American Hockey League, and have a championship. The only one that I missed was the Stanley Cup. And I would have loved to have been that. I was probably very close to being there. Mm-hmm. At that point in time, Mr. Semenko was going to retire, and my name came up as the replacement for him. So, and they went on to win another, I think, three Stanley Cups after that. So I would have had my Stanley Cup ring, but such is life.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. And I missed that by about 24 hours when he decided that he wasn't going to retire and come back. And that was a stipulation of the trade that Buffalo had made with Edmonton. If he should come back, then the trade's off. If not, then I'm in Edmonton. And the thing was that there had been a couple of players playing on Edmonton at the time that I had played juniors with. One notable player that everyone would know is Kevin Lowe. Mm-hmm. Him and I played in Quebec City together with the Ramparts.
Okay, so listen, we're gonna get back to, you know, you almost being able to play with the great one, Wayne Gretzky. But I wanted you to paint a picture to everybody out there on how you got into hockey. You know, I know you were born in Florida, but you didn't start playing until your family moved. Take us to that point from, you know, where you moved to and how you got into hockey.
Okay. The move started when I was about 3 years old. And we moved to New York from Ocala, Florida. And my dad at the time was an overseer on a very large potato farm. And so his job was to get the seeds in the ground, get the plants ready, and just get them growing before the migrant workers were brought up, probably late June, July. And they would stick around until about August. So from there, I was only maybe 10, three when that happened. So I advanced through the years and came up to the age of about 12 years old. So at that time, I was kind of a chunky little kid. So I was put into soccer to try and lose a little bit of weight, but and actually learn a little bit of discipline and the game to play. So, I played soccer for my mom, I guess you could say. And she was that soccer mom, took me to soccer practice and to the games and all of that. And then one winter at Christmas time, my birthday was coming up. So my dad said, I'm going to give you an early birthday present. So he gave me a pair of hockey skates.
Okay.
So I'm looking at these hockey skates, and I had been already exposed to the game. I'd been down at the rink, which was the Comac Arena in Comac, New York. So I was already kind of liking the game. I didn't understand the game quite yet. And actually getting on a pair of skates was crazy. You know, it's like, okay, I can walk perfectly well on the ground, but now I'm on ice on two little thin blades. I gotta learn this quick. So I got in, and since I'm pretty sure that since my dad kind of ran the rink, I was advanced through the teams pretty fast because all of a sudden I'm on this all-star team. I can barely stand up. You know, I can get up and down the ice, but, you know, as for turning and stopping and all that, that was still coming.
Right.
So I got fed up one night. I was playing on the Banton All-Star team, and the play was going in one direction, and I kind of was with the play, not really, but I got down to the offensive end. It was a turnover, and the puck started going back the other way. So I made this huge round turn. Uh-huh. By the time I got turned around, the play was coming back at me. So now I got to make this big turn and go back the other way. So now that the play's going back the other way, and I'm kind of like, man, this is crazy. I'm so embarrassed. I was so dejected. So from that point on, I said, you know what? I'm going to learn how to skate so that I'll never look this bad again. And I was able to advance pretty quickly. Now, I put in lots of hours in order to be able to get to juniors, because from that step, it was junior. It was a step to jump from Long Island or American hockey, which was pretty much non-existent at the time. We were just starting to get a national team in that. So I would work with my dad during the summer, and I would go with him in at 7 a.m. and the job ended probably 5:30, 6 p.m. And by 7:30, I was on the ice, and I'd be on the ice from that time till about 1, 2 a.m. With anybody that was renting the ice that would let me play, I'd play, you know, throw my $10 in and away we go. So I did this for a couple of years, and we had a gentleman who was in our organization, Buzz Deschamps, who had ties up in Midland, Ontario with the Junior B team. Now that Junior B team had not been playing for the last couple of years. They were just pulling the team back together. So he figured, you know, why not? You guys go out and try out. They're trying out a whole lot of other people. So we made our way up to Canada. It was 6 of us that came. And
how old are you at this time?
At this time, I'm about 15. I turned 16 during the season, which would be in February. So okay. I was close to the age. Actually, I was the age because they let me play. But we had to stop in Toronto and be assessed by the Ontario Hockey Association. And the gentleman doing the assessment was George Armstrong. I don't know if too many people remember him, but he ran the Toronto Marlies for many, many, many years. He was president, vice president, and coach to boot. So, mm-hmm. You know, he had the whole market covered there. So he looked at us for a couple of days, and then he called us all in, and we thought for sure we had failed. We're getting thrown out, that we're not good enough, and we thought we knew we were good enough. And then he just said to us, you know what? You guys are good enough, but I have to keep you guys for another 3 days. I'm obligated to keep you for 5 days and assess you. So your assessment will continue, but at this point in time, I just want to let you know that you're doing very well, and just keep up what you're doing because you will make it into the Ontario Hockey Association.
Nice.
And from there, yeah, it was pretty nice. We didn't know what to expect when we came up to play Canadian hockey because we'd heard all these stories about how good everybody was. And don't get me wrong, everybody were excellent skaters. And excellent players. They had hockey sense, and that was pretty much what we were trying to learn when we came up here, the actual intricacies of hockey sense. And that was taught to us through the junior system in Ontario. Well, that part of it anyway. So I spent 2 years in Midland, and I did 2 years in Quebec City. Now, Quebec City is the Quebecois League is a very fast skating league even back then. So that was another thing that helped pick up my skating ability as well. And with my coach at that time was Ron Rousset, who is deceased at this point, God rest his soul. He was another one who was very kind to me and very instrumental in me being able to advance to the point where I could make a pro team. And of course, there's always that last little bit that they give you the advice that they think you need in order to succeed in what you're doing. And at that time, it was just a matter for me to get a little better with the puck, a little more skating, and make sure I don't get my butt kicked too much because I was an enforcer, right?
Did your family come up with you when you came to play to Canada? Okay.
Well, my family didn't come with me, Elijah. My mom was so set against the whole idea. She didn't want me to leave home. She didn't understand that if you're going to advance and stuff, you have to go to where the hockey is good enough to help you to advance. But my dad kind of, I can remember probably the weekend before I was supposed to go that my mom and dad had a pretty big blowout about the fact that I was leaving home. She didn't want it, and he said I'd be fine. And then they went over the whole thing. They didn't know I could hear about how, what kind of names I'd be called and all that. And the thing about that is that my dad took me aside and we talked about all of this. Mm-hmm. He goes, you know that you're getting into a sport where you're going to be defiled and every other kind of thing that's going to happen. You're going to be called lots of names. Now, the thing is, do you think you can handle it? Do you think that you'll be able to succeed and excel in what you do? Because if you don't, I can put you into something else.
Mm. And this is when you were 15?
Yeah, at that point, I was 15. I'm going to turn 16 in next February.
It's interesting because I know you were very close with your father. So I'm wondering, how did you deal with that conversation? Because, in New York, you might have kind of heard that there was going to be some issues, but now your dad's sitting you down and he's giving it to you playing as a man, as a young man at 15, 16 years old. How did you take that conversation and how did you use that to apply to you going forward in the game of hockey?
Well, I took the conversation very well because of the fact that all the people and all my friends that I hung around with, we were already multi-diversified at that point. We had Irish people, we had Italians, we had blacks, we had every race you could think of, we all hung around together. So as for racial separation and all that, we had none. So I was prepared to go out into a world that would maybe be a little bit hostile to me, but I already had all the tools to be able to deal with it. Now, the thing is, when you are dealing with racism, it's usually comes up as something of people not understanding each other. And as long as you can make people take you as an individual and actually listen to you, well, then the race thing just goes right out the window. Now they take you for a person. They don't take you for a black or for a yellow or a green or purple. And that's pretty much where I was at that point in time. Of course, it always hurts when you hear it, especially when you're that young. Your skin isn't quite as thick as it's going to get. But if you can rationalize everything that's happening and realize that the fact that a lot of times when people, they don't even know what they're saying. They're just saying something that they've heard before and they figure it's going to get under your skin. And that's the whole idea behind it. Now, I probably say that out of the 100% of people that were calling you that, 75% of them were serious about it and the other 25 weren't. You know, they were just going along with the crowd. So once you can break down that mob mentality type of thing when it comes to racism, then people will take you as an individual. Mm-hmm. Now, they may not like anyone else from your race, but at that point, you have to start somewhere. Now, if they're going to talk to you, eventually they'll talk to someone else. And that's the whole idea here, is to get everyone on the same page.
And during your career, I mean, you dealt with a lot of racism through your playing years. What kept you going? I mean, I can't even imagine how hard that would have been to face that on a nightly basis. And
well, you know, Elijah, I'm not going to lie and say it was easy. It was a hard thing because, you know, you get ready, you know, when you're at home, everything's great. No one's really throwing any racial slurs at you. It's when you go on the road when things get really bad. And it was always, okay, I'm going to this town. It's going to be a real slur fest this night. So you got to get the thick skin on. And wanting to make it to the NHL, wanting to play a better brand of hockey and be recognized for making it there, that's what kept me going all those years. And I wasn't going to let anything stand in the way to stop.
Did you ever feel like you wanted to quit, or were you ever real close to saying, well, you know what, I'm done with this?
We all have those. You know, you get those bad nights where all of a sudden it may be very overwhelming, but you just have to go take a step back and reassess why you're doing this and what you have to do to get there. And then put the rest of that stuff out of your mind. You know, it's hard to do, but as long as you can throw a kind of a blanket over it, you can deal with it. But the problem with that is, and throwing a blanket over things like that and putting them back in your subconscious, they are going to resurface at some time. So you have to be prepared for that as well, which I wasn't, because once I retired, it really screwed me up, and I had to step away from the sport for many, many years before I even came back.
Most of your career, you kind of played that crash and bang style. Were you okay with that role?
I knew I could play the other style, but the thing was that this is what they hired me for. They wanted me to crash into the corners. And if anything happened, they wanted me to protect the players and maybe go out and change the makeup of the game by having a fight and getting the crowd on our side. And so I would rather have been able to be a player rather than an enforcer. But at that point in time, the way hockey was structured, you did what you had to do to get to stay in the game. And at that point in time, I really didn't have that option to be able to say, well, I'm not fighting anymore. I'm going to go play hockey, because if I tried to do that, you know, I would have been out the door on my butt pretty quick.
You know, you were actually drafted by the Red Wings back in 77, but you never got a chance to play with the Red Wings. You told me this story. The story is in your book. I want everyone, I need you to tell everybody what happened during training camp.
Okay. Well, this story starts in a Memorial Cup the year before.
Yes.
Okay. So I was playing with the Ramparts. We were lucky enough to, well, we were fortunate enough to have beaten out the Sherbrooke Beavers. And believe it or not, I had another player on there who eventually we ended up playing together on the same team. That would be Rick Vibe. So I've known Rick Vibe since juniors, right?
Legend.
Okay, so we went to the Cup. We're playing New Westminster, and this little weasel, every time he went by, he would throw the N-bomb at me, or some type of watermelon joke or some other kind of crap like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's an important game. You don't really want to jump out there and start destroying people. So it got to the point where I was really pissed off at this kid. So he said it the one time. I chased him right to his bench, and he ended up jumping in between Harold Philipoff and Barry Beck, you know, two Redwoods to begin with. And so I looked at them and I go, look, you guys play a fair game. I'm not here for you guys, but if I got to go through you guys to get to him, I will. And they kind of both looked the other way. So I knew it was okay. There's a green light. So I told the guy, the next time I catch you on the ice, I'm going to tear your head off. Unfortunately, I never got on the ice out there with him again. Right. And turns out I get drafted by Detroit. I go to their camp, and all of a sudden, guess who's there? Yeah, so it was, I'm looking at this going, oh man, I can't believe my luck, you know. So now it took me 3 days to get into the scrimmage with the squad that he was playing for in camp. And we got out on the ice, it happened. He come across, I cross-checked them, and I said, you remember me? I go, Memorial Cup, racial slurs, dropped the gloves and started cleaning his clock. Mm-hmm. I got him. I was beating him really good. Okay, so I got him down. I sorted down, and I'm feeding him. And I vaguely, in the back of my mind, I could hear somebody saying, stop, stop, stop. But, you know, I was so enraged and so pissed off from what happened a year ago that all went by the wayside. And so finally, someone kicks my skates out. My hand hits the ice. I look over at my hand, and I see a skate blade go by like inches away from it. And I'm like, oh, man, that was close. Could have lost my fingers and all that. So being undisciplined is the word I'm going to use, because that's what it was. Mm-hmm. I jump up and scream, who the F kicked my skates out? I could have had my fingers cut off. Somebody skated right by my fingers. And finally, I focus up in his head coach, Bobby Crom. So at that point, I'm like, oh, geez, what did I just do? But it was too late for that. It was already done. So I got kept on for another couple of years, another couple of weeks. What am I saying? And, I ended up going down. I got to play a couple of games with the Kalamazoo Wings. And then from there, I couldn't go anywhere. Because at that point in time, the junior rule was that you couldn't play juniors if you were 21 years old. And since my birthday came during the season, I lost that entire year. They've since changed the rule. But at that point in time, the rule was what it was. I couldn't go back to junior, so what I had to do was I had to find somewhere else to play. And what I did was I went and played in the U.S. League. And that was a bunch of teams that were out in sort of in the Midwestern part of the states. And I went to the Sioux City, Iowa team, which was right across the border from Sault Ste. Or St. Marie, more or less. And I did my part of my season there. I think I had 17 games with them or something. And then from there, I ended up coming back east and going into Toronto with Etobicoke and playing for the Dixie Beehives for the remainder of their season, which ended probably, I think, the end of January or something. But nonetheless, I was still getting time and playing with guys that had decent abilities in the sport.
Do you regret flying off the handle during that time? Because who knows what have been, you know, your career? And did they explain to you? Did they say anything to you after that happened?
Oh, no, of course not. No, but I was smart enough to realize that you can have the most powerful weapon in the world, but if you can't control it, it's no good to you. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much what happened right there. I wouldn't say I was the most powerful weapon in the world, but I was on my way to becoming one, right? Mm-hmm. So I do regret the fact that I didn't have the discipline to stop fighting when I was told. And from that moment on, that's what would train me that any fight that I got into on the ice, as soon as the refs would stop fighting, I would stop fighting. Okay, they didn't have to worry about dragging me off of somebody or dragging me to the penalty box. Once the fight was over, just said, okay, guys, let's go. Fight's over. I'm going to sit down for my 5 minutes and come back. So, yes, I regret it. And I'd like to say to all the young people out there that are listening to this, that discipline probably is going to be the most important part of your life. Now, there's going to be times, and already in their lives, you don't want to get up and go to school, but you get up and go anyways. Now, once you get there, you're going to get into the day, and it won't seem so bad, but you just have to have the discipline to get up and do everything every day the way you're supposed to. Now, the kids get a little upset with their parents for being so forceful and always on them about things, but that's the only way to be able to train a child to realize what's going on. And once you get up in years, you realize that all that training was for your own good. Like, I know that my dad was kind of hard on me, but in the end, I realized this probably at the age of 14, 15, what it was all about. So I was very appreciative to him for giving me all the tools that I needed to deal with society on an even keel, if you want to call it that, at the time, because nothing was ever even back in those days. Now, that's one of those things that we're in a racism mode that it just keeps on giving, and that's not a good thing.
You played a lot of your hockey in Canada. Was there a huge culture adjustment for you?
Well, yeah, sort of. Like, the difference between the States and Canada when it comes to the cultural thing is that in the States, if somebody doesn't like you or doesn't like your race or that, you're going to know about that immediately. But when I came to Canada, the biggest thing was that people would be nice to you, but they would hate your guts all under their breath, right, pretty much. And I learned that the people up here are willing to take the moment out of their lives to find out who you are before they start actually getting on your case. And as long as you represent yourself as an individual, as a human being, who's respectful of other people and will do anything to help other people, well, that type of thing you can't deny. And with all the people that I've come into contact with in Canada, they've been very, very nice people. And people that would bend over backwards to give you a hand or give you that step up that you would need. And everyone needs that once in a while, because you don't go anywhere on your own. There's always someone behind you helping you, or someone in front of you pulling you along.
Agreed. You know, while you were playing in the 80s, who were the other black players that you saw or heard about?
I heard about the first black player that I actually saw was Alton White, and that was in the World Hockey Association when they broke in. And we had the connection with the New York Rangers, and they sponsored the league that I played in, which was called the Metropolitan League, which Lou Varrow, who is with USA Hockey, was one of the guys that put the program together with John Muffler. And what would happen was the Rangers would pay for all the ice time for all the teams, and each team got one game a year at Madison Square Gardens. And, you know, for kids, that's like, wow, really? Madison Square Gardens? It was incredible. So they would give us tickets to go see games. You got every team got a team that they would give them tickets for and they could go see. And I went to see I didn't know Alton White at the time. And when we were going, one of the players said, well, you know, there's a black player on this team, Alton White. I go, okay. So once I saw him, I kind of did a little research, and I found out about Mr. Reed, who had broken the color barrier back in 1958. I was only a year old at the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because of all the struggles that he had to go through, that made it possible for the rest of those guys that came along later on to get a leg up on the sport and get an opportunity to try and play. Now, there's been a lot of things that have transpired since those times, and I'm sure that I had it rough. I couldn't imagine how Mr. Aree had it. It had to have been pretty tough on him.
Yeah.
You know, especially since he was the only black that was playing the sport pretty much in the country.
It's interesting. For one, for those who don't know who Alton White is, Alton White is the second black athlete to play professional hockey, not necessarily in the NHL, but the second black player to play professional hockey. And of course, it was very hard for Willie, you know. But the one thing is, a lot of people just don't realize is Willie wasn't the only black player playing at the time. There were a lot of black players playing throughout the country.
Just unrecognized.
Exactly. You know, in my film, which I, you know, obviously really appreciate the fact that you were in it.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. Mike Marsden talked about going into training camp and trying to get people, the audience, to imagine what it would be like to go into a dressing room and to see nobody that looks like you. You're the only one that walks in the dressing room like that, and how uncomfortable that could feel for somebody. Would you agree with that? And paint a picture for everybody, you know, during the 70s and 80s when you were playing hockey, what that was like to go into these dressing rooms and just be the only black player.
Well, it was kind of hard because first off, when you go into with a new team, you got to get to know your players. And then after you get to know the players a little bit, now you start to find out the personalities. And once you find out the personalities, then you know, this guy doesn't like black guys. This guy doesn't like Chinese guys. This guy doesn't like this type of guy. And I was fortunate enough that during my minor hockey days, everyone in the locker room was white. I was the only black guy there. And my brothers, of course. My blood brothers, my Henry and Bobby, but they didn't go on to play the sport to the level that I did. It wasn't that they weren't good enough. It's just that they didn't want to put up with all that racial stuff, and they pretty much come right out and said it. Right. Like my brother was the youngest, who was Robert. He was a phenomenal hockey player, but he didn't want any part of it. So he ended up going into the Navy and doing his thing that way. Now, after being trained, I guess you could say, and going into these locker rooms and seeing it all the time when I was younger, it made it a little easier on me to walk into a locker room that was predominantly white and just kind of keep my spot and pay attention to what was going on. I guess that's mostly it, because there are a lot of people out there, doesn't matter whether you're on their team or not, they're going to try to hurt you. Mm. And the only thing that kept people from trying that with me was the fact that, you know, you try that with me, I'm going to clean your clock. Okay. And there's just not going to be any second chances, because racism to me is something that doesn't belong in any sport, let alone hockey. But like I said, back then, hockey was still, and I hate to use this phrase, a white man's sport. And it at this point in time, we are now turning a corner where evolution is taking over and everyone is trying to make sure that the playing field is level for everybody. And even making great sorts going outside of the box to make sure that this happens. And that's what we need. You know, I've seen all of the efforts that the NHL has made to make the playing field even. The biggest thing about that is that they're actually doing. Okay, so a lot of these other clubs and places where they're having these type problems, you're going to have to reevaluate everything and just revamp your whole program. There's no way around it. The world is changing. The, you know, evolution is going to come, and there's going to be a lot of people that are not going to like it. But you know what? It's like family. It's always the black sheep in the family that you don't like, but you get along with them. And that's pretty much what we're going to have to do in society now, and try not to step on each other's toes too much. And the only way to do that is to educate people on what cultures are, dislikes of this culture, and try not to step over the line. And in the beginning, it's always a tough process because of the sheer fact that no one wants change.
Right.
And when you're forced to change, it hurts even more. But if you go along with it, things do work out, you don't really lose anything. You know, if anything, you're gaining something. You're gaining all the personalities. You're gaining all the talent. You're gaining all the skill level of all these other people that you thought you didn't like.
For when you first started off in hockey to when you got older, did you see the racism in hockey get better or worse for you?
Well, for me, I'd have to say it got better for the sheer fact that when I first broke into the pros, I was playing semi-pro with the Erie Blades out of Erie, Pennsylvania, and a lot of our games are played down south. So, you know, a black man going down south, people kind of look at you like, wait a minute, what are you doing? Why are you here? And that's pretty much the questions that I got all the time. Who are you and why are you here? What are you doing? Why are you playing this sport? Don't you have your own sport to play? You know, these are the type of things that I was hearing all the time. So it was rough, very rough during that thing because I had whole stands yelling stuff at me. It wasn't like it was two or three people. And, you know, all that throwing bananas and stuff. I went through all of that. Okay. That was just a prerequisite for going down south. I guess it became the joke of, okay, how many bananas are going to be on the ice tonight?
Wow.
When you walk into a rink, which is kind of screwed up if you think about it.
And that's why I feel like guys like yourself, Willie O'Ree, Tony McKegney, Mike Marzen are so important to where we are going. And if we do not recognize you guys and recognize what you went through, how do we even get better? Because Elijah has never gone through anything like you have gone through. And he's played on many teams where he's the only black player to play on that. So I think there's an appreciation for what you have gone through and the fact that you are able to give us lessons going forward. But in your book, you write about your first NHL game. Tell me what stood out the most for you on that very first night.
Just being there. okay. And it was like going into a Hollywood movie. You walk in, everybody's got the beautiful Buffalo Sabres sweaters on. You're looking around, the stands are full. People are screaming your name or wondering or looking at each other going, where the hell did he come from?
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was one of those times that I felt really great. I was very happy to be there. And was trying to do anything I could to actually help the team. And that's the bottom line.
Who were some of the guys on that team?
Oh, man. Lindy Ruff, Larry Playfair, Richie Dunn, Mike Ramsey, Tony McKegney. Even had a little time with Grant Fuhr was there for a little bit, too.
Mm.
You know, Javert Perreault, Rennie Robert, you know, all the guys that everyone thinks of as the hockey legends, I had the opportunity. Mr. Scotty Bowman was our coach. Nick Polano was our assistant. And I had played 3 years prior to that in Erie, Pennsylvania with Mr. Polano, who is now deceased, God rest his soul. And he was very instrumental in getting me to an NHL contract. Now, my first year when I went to Erie, I was just a walk-on. And he took good care of me, saw the potential in me, and gave me exercise and things like that to do in order to get to the National League. But once I got there, like we were saying, it was like glamour and blitz. It was like, it's like going from, I'd say, a Bantam team to a major A, triple A team. Right. You know, that's the difference in the step.
Night and
even
day.
Though it's only the American Hockey League to the National League, it's still that much of a big step. The guys are probably a step and a half faster than the guys that you're playing with in that league. But if you have that talent, you will get faster because now you have to get faster if you want to keep up. And that's what keeps you improving.
Scotty Bowman is a legend in the hockey circles. What was he like? What you know, how did he touch your spirit as a hockey player?
I was really amazed at how calm he was always. You know, and even when he got pissed off, he wasn't he'd scream a little bit, but not a whole lot. Mm-hmm. But you know, here's a gentleman that we're coming in to play for who already has 4 or 5 Stanley Cup rings on his finger. You know, because remember, he coached the Montreal Canadiens for all those years.
Right.
And won Stanley Cup. So it was like, you know, you're kind of stepping on eggshells when you're walking by him. And the thing was, he taught me about the quick starts and to getting the shots off quicker and making sure to stay with your man. Because at that point, I was having problems with covering men on the back check. You know, I was a little leery of where I should be on the ice at any certain point in time. And they were able to bring me up to speed on that. And, you know, they had, like, Jimmy Roberts was there. And, there were a lot of guys that just came up and helped. I know, I remember Lindy Ruff took me under his wing. So did Larry Playfair. And they helped me through those times that would be super hard. It was like when I came up, it was like I'd always been with the team forever. So
Lindy Ruff told me that you and Playfair, you guys weren't out there to do a lot of hockey playing. You guys were out there to just kind of interrupt the game a little bit.
Well, yes, we did interrupt the game a lot of it.
How was it playing with those two?
Oh, man, they were great. It was like our line was, I was the left winger, Lindy was the center, and Larry was the right winger. That's how we started the game. And our sole job was to go in and get at least two body hits each in one shift.
Right.
Okay, so you got six big guys, probably over 200 pounds, okay, just running amok, if you want to put it like that. And the thing was, we were doing it sensibly. We were playing the game, and if the check came up, you know, you take the guy out, you take him out hard. You know, you don't pussyfoot with him. So, and this more or less sent a message to the other team, well, you know, this is going to be a long night for you. Every time you turn around, someone's going to be running you over. So get used to it. And as soon as you get people looking over their shoulder or being a little tentative about making a pass, you got them. Okay, this there because now they're so busy worried about whether you're going to run them over that their precision in passing or precision in shooting is all out the window.
What are your thoughts of what's going on today in the hockey world with the social justice movement as well as what the Hockey Diversity Alliance is trying to do?
I think it's a wonderful thing. I think it's about time that it's happened. And I'd like to thank the NHL personally, myself, for what they've done in order to make the changes. Now, I've read all the guidelines and all the changes that the BHA has in place, and that has been accepted by the National Hockey League. So you got to say thank you. And the other thing is that now that we're at this point, we have the world listening to us. And it's unfortunate that we had to take it to the point where we had to do it through sports, because people always think that sports is a getaway from regular life and all that. But things are going so awry out there that it's now starting to spill over into all the sports. So someone has to say something and do something so to bring awareness to the problem, and maybe people will see it. Like back in the day when I was playing, we didn't have video phones. We didn't have all of that. So all this other stuff that was happening always went by the wayside. Nobody really knew about it. They heard about it, but it's all, no, that can't be happening. But now people are seeing it firsthand, and they realize how bad it is. So this is, we're now in a stage of flux, and there's going to be a lot more turmoil before this gets better. But if everyone decides they want to work together, and anyone who doesn't know what all the things for the alliance are, they should probably go online and look it up and see what this all is, and they'll see how the National League is taking the steps to level out the playing field for all, not just players, for management, and for anyone who's connected with the sport that's representing the sport. Now, we're at that point now where I don't know if what you can do about the irate fan. Now, that's another thing that you have to address, probably suspensions, fines, things like that would work, because when you're taking money out of somebody's pocket, and at this point, you can't really fine a fan. So the only thing you could do is probably suspend them. Okay, revoke their privilege to come to the game and plaster their face on the wall like a wanted poster and saying, well, this guy has been suspended for such and such, okay? And, you know, I guess you could call that public humiliation, but that's probably the only way. And it's like anything else. Once you shame someone, a lot of the people will think about what they've done and improve themselves. A lot of people just won't give a crap and just say, forget it, and keep on doing what they're doing. And those are the people that we have to convince. You know, you have to look at the world in a different way. The world is changing, and you have to change along with it. And it's like that old saying, the strong survives, but you know, we can't be violent about stuff. And that brings us to the other social things that are happening with the Black Lives Matter. You know, they're doing a wonderful job. But the thing is that when you're being called a terrorist and all that kind of thing, now you've got to change your way of thinking. Now, any kind of thing that you put on, now you have to have certain hours to do it so that you get all your people off the street, so that anybody that does anything after that certain hour has no connection to your cause. And that's where they seem to be falling short, because you can't, number one, try to demonstrate into the night, because there's just too many unknowns that are going to happen. You have people coming out that had nothing to do with your cause at all, and they're the ones that are causing all the trouble. But since your people are there, the blanket is falling on everybody. So you have to get your people off the streets by 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, because at that time, if you haven't gotten your message across, you're not getting it across. That's like going to the bar that closes at 11. If you haven't done anything by 10, 10:30, you ain't doing anything, so go home.
Yeah. I agree with you in a sense, but at the same time, I will say that it doesn't matter what is done in the movement. They're always going to find a way to make the movement seem like it's criminal, make the movement seem like it's disrespectful to the flag, to make it seem like it's causing trouble. There's always going to be that. So no matter what we do, silent, respectful, the way they want us to do it, it doesn't matter. We're still going to get labeled. So I think it's just one of those things that we just have to keep. We just got to keep keeping on, man. We just got to keep moving.
I agree with you 100% on that, Kwame. But this is more or less like a damage control type of thing, so that you can maybe curtail a little bit of that. You're not going to stop it all. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. But maybe you can stop 15-20% of
it. You know what, Val? Talk about what it was like for your playing career when it was over. Was it difficult for you to adjust? You know, I remember you and I talking about some of the psychological issues that you had to deal with for many years. I remember people saying to me, oh my God, where was Val? He's been gone for so long. Where did that come from, and how did you deal with it before you decided to write your book?
Well, I was going through still that rejection part about not being accepted, you know, and it wasn't just the hockey world, it was more or less everything, you know, the fans, the game, and I was pretty well accepted in the game. I can't complain about that, but you know what, after many, many years of being called the N-bomb or whatever else, all those other words that they can use, and I don't really say those words, because why should I? I don't want them to get out there. I want these phrases to die, and as long as we keep repeating them, they're going to stay alive. But I felt that even when I wasn't, after it was all over with, I found that all that name calling just kept coming back. You know, it all of a sudden it would be just in your head, and it was really not a whole lot. So I had, in order to try and stop that, I had to stop looking at the sport, because if I looked at the sport, all those things that were said to me would come right back, and they'd be just bouncing around in my head as I'm watching the game. Oh, well, I remember being in Richmond, this guy was saying this. So I remember walking out on the ice and this chick called me this. I remember standing there, I was looking this way, and this guy tells me, why am I looking at the white woman? And it's like, wow, you know, but those are the things that were happening, you know, and it's like, I'm not looking at the white woman. I just happen to be looking in that direction. Sorry about that. And the thing is, I shouldn't have to be sorry about using my eyesight to see things, but that's how things were. And that totally knocked me off stride for, I'd say, a good 18, 20 years. Yeah. You know, you're thinking to yourself, am I not good enough to be in society? And it doesn't matter what's happening around you at that exact time. You're still stuck in what has already happened to you. And then it kind of makes life a little tougher. Real life. I call hockey the glamour life. And once you get to real life, you know, it's a whole new story. Now, I know personally of athletes who have achieved great, great things. And in society, if something happens, if they're somewhere, they're trying to buy something, all of a sudden they're just the end bomb to somebody. Okay. And it's like, and then once they find out who this person is, all of a sudden the story changes. But why should it have to change like that because of who you are? It should be like that normally. You know, I get it, but I don't get it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. When you got to writing your book when you were done, was that a form of therapy for you?
Yeah, actually it was. It completely let me get all of the things off of my chest that had been going rattling around in my brain, and it was such a therapeutic aid. You know, I have to send a shout out to John Gallagher and thank him for that. I have to thank Lou Varrow for all he's done for me. I have to thank Stephanie Jackson for what she's done in all of these things, because I was out doing a little grassroots hunting on my own there a little bit before this pandemic hit, and actually seeing the young kids that want to pursue the sport, don't know how or don't have the funds or the resources to get it done. I saw so many single parents, mostly mothers, bringing their kids to the hockey rink and sitting there with them. And it's really nice that they're trying to give them a step up on life. But, you know, at this point, they can only do so much. You know, you in a house league, how high can you go? You know, you have to have a highway to a better league. And first off, you have to have programs in place that are going to make the players able to get to these better leagues on their skill alone. So that's where we are right now. Racism, like I said, has taken a turn, and I'm so happy to see that now we're seeing what's happening all over the world. If we're on the world stage, and when you're on the world stage like this, that's when it's time to make a stand and make the change that you need to make. Now, in the beginning, it's going to be tough because, like I said earlier, people are very adverse to change. It's like they think something's going to get taken away from them, mm-hmm. when it's nothing's going to get taken away. And like I said, it's just going to enrich your life a little bit more. And we have to look at it from that point of view. I'm pretty sure that if we were totally congealed as a race, that we'd have more scientific discoveries that are made. Because of the sheer fact that all these people that are super smart, that aren't getting the chances or were not getting the chances, are now going to start getting those chances. So we're going to see a huge leap in what technology can offer. We're going to see a huge leap in all these other programs that we have out there. So as long as we work together, I think it'll work. And Kwame knows about the fruit salad thing, so I won't use that. And the wife's already laughing. So, you know, like I said, it's like a fruit salad. It's no fruit salad, but just strawberries. You got to throw the pears, the lemons, the oranges. Sorry about that, bananas. And then, you know, it all looks good together. It's nice and colorful, and it all works together on the taste buds.
That's right.
We have to look at it like that. You know, we've got all of these flavors out here that they could come together and taste good together.
Yeah. You know, in your playing career, your years of playing, you fought some legends. Who would you say would have been your toughest opponent? And talk about, you know, knowing that you were that close to possibly playing with Wayne Gretzky and watching his back.
Yeah, well, let me see. I've had the honor of fighting Mr. Terry O'Reilly, Dave Brown. I fought Rod Langway, but that didn't go so good for me.
Would you say Terry O'Reilly was probably your toughest opponent?
Terry O'Reilly was tough, but I have to say the toughest opponent when it comes to stand up and throw him would have been Dave Brown. And the one person that gave me the most trouble, even with not people not really knowing him that much, was a gentleman named Jay Frazier. He was a good fighter. I can remember he gave me a punch that kind of made me see stars. So. I was, he's a really nice guy, too. Him and I are friends. It's not like we were enemies, but we're playing on opposite teams and stuff happens, you know. I've had the opportunity of fighting some really good legendary people, and I appreciated all of that. And the thing is, we look at it like this, that we cannot survive. At that point, we could not survive in the sport without each other. So it was one of those things we knew. Okay, when are we going to do it? Is it going to be the first period, second period, third period? We're going to keep people on their seats. So it's like, you know, if you go out there and get it over with right in the beginning, there's no suspense for the fans. So you got to wait a couple of periods, you know, get them into it. And the idea of being able to play and protect Wayne Gretzky's back, man, I thought it was wonderful. I always had those thoughts. I hope I can do it right, you know, but it would have been marvelous. I was – I was gone home. I was sad for it. I was a little sad that I got traded, because I don't like that word trade. Nobody liked the word trade back then. So
would you say you really embraced that role and kind of looked forward to it, or was it just kind of something like, I gotta do this tonight?
Say I looked forward to it, but I was going to do what it took to stay there. You know, and since I was pretty good with my Dukes, you know, that got me there, then I only got noticed doing that in juniors by accident. I just happened to fight guys that had been the toughest guys in the league. I didn't know it at the time, and I beat them. So right then, the label stuck. Okay, this guy's an enforcer. That's what he's going to be. That's what we're going to draft him for, his toughness.
Yeah, I've been working with Kwame for quite a bit, and, you know, I find he's a pretty easy guy to work with. I want to know what your experience working with him was like, and what was it like being in his movie, Soul and Ice, Past, Present, and Future?
Kwame was top-notch. You know, anything I didn't know, he taught me. Okay, so, and, you know, when you're stepping from a normal world into a film world, there are certain things that you must do, and there's things that you don't do. And Kwame was good enough to bring me along and show me all of these things. And I thought it was just a fantastic time working with Kwame. It was the whole time we ever worked together. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good time.
Kwame's a great guy.
You know, what's really cool, a little behind the scenes story, of course, you know, I interviewed Val for the film. And Val, remember when we went to New York and you sat down with Willie and Anson Carter? You had that little roundtable discussion. That's the first time I had met Willie O'Ree. Because do you remember we were talking and I was trying to get Willie in the film and we couldn't. You were like, I'm going to go meet him next week. Just come down with me. So I literally bum rushed the NBC studios.
I remember that because we laughed about the whole thing.
That was good times.
That was a good time. And you know what? It's played out well, right?
Did it worked out, because if it wasn't for that moment, I don't know if I would have gotten Willie O'Ree, you know, because I came there, filmed that stuff with you, because you basically said to these, you said to them, like, well, this guy is with me, he's doing the film. So right. I came in there solo and worked that out. And then the next day I went down to I went back to Toronto, they went to Philadelphia and shot the Willie O'Ree weekend, and then I was able to lock that down. So I'm so grateful for meeting you and having you a part of the film. You and Ina were just great to be around all that time. We did some screenings together, and it was just a lot of fun, man. And I'm just really glad that I was able to, along with what you did with your book, have you in the film. Because like I said, and I'll say that always, it's so important that people recognize the people that came before you and what they did.
Right. Well, I just got to give you a heartfelt thanks, Kwame, for even involving me in the film. And thank you for coming to New York with me to film more for the film. Mm-hmm. And I'm extremely ecstatic at the fact that I was able to get you somewhere and you take the ball and go with it and do what you had to do. You know, like I told you a couple of weeks ago, I'm extremely proud of what you've achieved in the last 5 years. And have my hats off to you. Congratulations. Great job.
Thank you, brother. Fifth anniversary is coming up October 7th. So can you imagine? It's been 5 years, bro.
Yeah, I can. But you know what? You beat those bushes pretty hard, my friend. But you have to, right?
You got to do it. And you got to do it together. So, Val, listen, before we let you go, we do this thing on the podcast. It's our top five songs. Now, you're an old school brother, so I know that the top five songs that you're going to be hitting us with are going to be some classics. So give us your top five songs that you are going to listen to before you get on the ice and do what you do best.
Okay. Number one, Another One Bites the Dust. Okay. Number two, We Are the Champions.
He likes his queen.
The Boys Are Back in Town.
Okay.
And number four, Pink Floyd, Smile On You Crazy Diamond. And my fifth one is Dark Side of the Moon.
You're a heavy rock guy.
I had another one in there I'll throw at you. Wish You Were Here.
Okay. You're a heavy rock and roll guy.
I do it all. I'm going to do it all.
But when you go like, on
I wanted to say Parliament, but that might be a little too sophisticated.
You think so? Okay. If you were to take a Parliament funkadelic song, what would it be?
The Mothership Connection.
There you go, baby. I love
okay.
that. See, a guy like Elijah needs to go and do a little Google searching because the Mothership Connection is heavy.
I got a few of those songs, Elijah, but the rest of them I'm going to have to go Google and give them a listen.
Well, the thing about the Parliament group, and I'm sure that everybody knows who George Clinton is. Do you, Elijah?
Yeah, I know who he is.
He has gone on from Parliament to do a lot of TV things. One of his biggest successes was the Red Shoe Diaries. No one knows that he was the man behind all the music for that.
I didn't know that either.
Oh, you didn't?
No, I didn't.
No, check out the credits. George Clinton.
Okay. A little history lesson from Val James. Thank you so much, man. And Val, once again, thank you for rocking with us on the podcast. I've had a couple of people message me and ask me when's Val James going to be on the show. So I cannot wait for them to listen to this episode. You've been great. You've always been great with your time. And we wish you all the best in the future, my friend.
Well, thank you very much, and I wish you guys all the best in your futures, but as it's going, I can see you're going to be doing just fine.
Thank you, Val. I appreciate that, and I just want to personally thank you for paving the way so players like me, Nikhil, and my younger brother and my kids can play hockey down the road, and, you know, without you and Mike Morrison and Willie O'Ree, none of this would be possible. So just thank you for paving the way.
You're very welcome.
Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, and I just want to thank you for the acknowledgement. And you know, that's one of those things you got me all mushy now. Oh man, you know what? No, it does. You know, that really jerks on the heartstrings, because especially when people actually realize what you had to go through, it's a beautiful thing. And I thank you guys, and all I ask out of you is to make us proud.
I do.
And you're already doing that, so keep up the good work.
Thank you.
With that being said, Val James, folks, thank you so much, man.
Okay, thank you, Kwam. Appreciate it.
That's Val James. And, you know, for those out there that want to hear about what it was like for the first American-born black athlete to play the game of hockey, make sure you pick up that book. It's called Black Ice, The Val James Story. Highly recommended. I think you'll learn a lot about him and what it was like for a guy like him to play the game of hockey in the 70s and the 80s. And, you know, I think, Elijah, what you said, you nailed it. You know, they went through so much just to open up the door for guys like you, guys like Akil, Vander Kane, Joe Ward, everybody to play the game of hockey. And, We have to give them their flowers while they're here. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, there's really like no other way to put it. And when you listen to the stories that he talked about, and he talked about people throwing bananas at him and like saying how many bananas are going to be on the ice tonight, hearing it firsthand is crazy. And to think like if I was going through that now, or someone else was going through that now, like, it's hard to think that you'd even be able to want to play. And, you know, for him to stick through all that and to just stay focused and motivated and want to make it to the NHL, and that's really special. And, you know, I really think that's why the game is growing so much, because people like him just stuck it out and they kept doing it, and they paved the way for all of us down the road.
If you ever watch my movie and you see the segment that is about Val James, you see in the crowd, this white kid with a watermelon. And the reporter asks him, you know, why do you have a watermelon? And he literally says, well, I thought that's what he'd want. So, like you said, they stuck it out, man. And, you know, they went through a lot for you guys to play this game, for a guy like me to be in the position to work within the game. So, our hats off to those guys. And, you know, we're going to have to do some more. We got to get Mike Mars, and we got to get Tony McKegney on. We got to hear some stories from those guys. So, yeah. big shout out to Val James, and make sure you pick up the book. And with that being said, thank you for joining us on the show. Elijah, you have yourself a good rest of your week.
And thank you,
thank you, sir. And when we come back next week, we'll come back with some more heat. So have yourself a great week, and we'll talk to you guys soon.
And when we make it, we gonna put our soul on ice. Cause when they doubted us, we did it twice. I guess the poop is in the freezer. They tried to get rid of us, but they need us. So I need you like you need me. I need you like you need me. We double up when our numbers come through the TV. Yeah. Soul on ice. I'ma put my soul on ice.
Nice. You goddamn right, I'm screaming on that beat. I got a match screaming on the streets. We in the club, stadium, and the arena, cousin. Put me on ice and I'm hitting that top. Trees are dusting, fussing, fighting with myself is enticing. My enemies in the mirror, and he's always reciting the poetry of my power, statistic of my weakness. Shadow boxing with Tyson, I'm trying to show y'all I'm beating them to the punch. Competition on the table, it's time for lunch. Though my mission is unstable, I'm scoring once, twice, three times, and I'm taking hats. Men lie, women lie, progress is based upon the facts. So let that baby shine. They sold a show and know the, they live within the grind. Now take them out that stroller, cause coming up is a champ. Prediction of Ali, he changed his name to Muhammad. We change him free to a fee. It's up to me. And when we make it, we gon' put our soul on ice. Cause when they doubted us, we did it twice. I guess the poop is in the freezer. They tried to get rid of us, but they need us. So I need you like you need me. I need you like you need me. We double up when our numbers come through the TV. Soul on ice, I'ma put my soul on ice. Nice. Let's dedicate this one to Jade and Linda. Let's escalate to Caddy, crush the Pinta. Or maybe you prefer that Benz, why? That big truck, I don't give a f***. Only really want a house for the gift. Let's take it far down on the competition. Competition is nonsense, it's me and my soul's decision. Yeah, I only work against myself. I play against you to bench you. I'm throwing all shots to the shelf. Yeah, the top is the topic. You checking your armor. My wheel telescopic, so I'm steering my karma. The future is mine, like receiving the pass from Jesus or Jordan or Crosby, Stills and Nash. We young, and when we make it, we gon' put our soul on ice. Cause when they doubted us, we did it twice. I guess the proof is in the freezer. They tried to get rid of us, but they need us. So I need you, like you need me. I need you, like you need me. When our numbers come through the TV. Soul on ice, I'ma put my soul on ice.
Nice.
Nice.